It is a little over a decade since the European Union last welcomed a new member, Croatia, which celebrated becoming the EU's 28th member on July 1st, 2013. Seconds after midnight, Croatia's capital, Zagreb, shook to the sound of fireworks and echoed to the strains of Beethoven's Symphony No. 9 in D minor, better known as the Ode to Joy, and as the EU's optimistic, if not downright exuberant, anthem. Since then, however, enlargement of the EU has not only stalled, but receded. The UK's tormented departure in 2020, following the Brexit referendum of 2016, reduced the bloc to 27 countries and seemed to add to the existential angst created by the Eurozone crisis of the early 2010s. Negotiations with candidate nations, mostly Croatia's Balkan neighbours, faltered and sputtered. However, just as Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in early 2022 roused NATO from introspective torpor, it did much the same for the EU. And in the 26 months since Russia attacked Ukraine, Europe's political and strategic centre has shifted significantly eastward. Candidate status has been granted to Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia, and negotiations have been revived with those countries which were already in the queue. Does the EU need to pick up the pace? What have been the sticking points? And might the UK edge towards rejoining? This is the Foreign Desk.
In Sweden, given the demography, we will need in the future people to move to Sweden. Europe will need people moving to Europe because we have a shortage of a workforce. We need a common legislation in Europe so that we can handle this together, giving refugees asylum that they have the right to have, but also making sure that we have the right workforce.
This is the basis of the European Union, doing things together and improving the life of the citizens. I can't wait that the war is over and we should orient ourselves towards that again.
The EU aren't getting out the party poppers at the prospect of a Labour government. Labour aren't proposing a wholesale review of post-Brexit trading relationships. And the EU, for their part, are thinking, OK, that's fine. If you want to negotiate something, we'll talk to you. But we're only going to give you something if it's in our interest. We're not going to give you presents because you're not Conservatives.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. We'll hear first of all from the former Swedish Prime Minister Stefan Löfven, who we met at the recent Delphi Economic Forum. Löfven is now president of the Party of European Socialists, who he will lead into EU parliamentary elections in June, elections likely to be dominated by far-right populists running hard against immigration, a divisive issue across the continent. I began by asking him how confident he was about the European Socialists' chances, with polls suggesting that Conservatives and far-right parties will gain seats.
Well, what we see in the last poll was actually one of those extreme groups is going down and one is going up. But from my point of view, every mandate extremists is no good. So, of course, we have to perform well. I think we have a strong manifesto for the people. We have a strong candidate for the Commission presidency. But we have to do well, absolutely, and take this very seriously because Europe is in a dangerous place if we have more right-wing extremists. We have them cooperating with the Swedish government. Mm. We have them in Finland. We have them in other countries as well. And that's not the future for Europe.
Does it strike you, though, that this election or these European elections are going to be essentially a referendum on immigration?
No, I don't think so. There are several issues on the agenda for people. The cost of living, we have many people having a hard time making ends meet because of the cost of living, the inflation, energy prices, social security is on the agenda. So it's not only that on the agenda. But of course, I'm fully aware that it is a big issue for many people.
The reason I'm asking this, of course, is that your government was a very pro-immigration government. You welcomed a great many people into Sweden very shortly after you took power in 2014, I think on your watch nearly a million people immigrated to Sweden, which is an addition to a population of 10.5 million is a significant chunk of the population. Do you think in retrospect you were perhaps naive, optimistic?
The truth is that the legislation that we had when we took power in October 2015, we had a legislation in place implemented by the former government, the Conservative government. Four parties in that government made an agreement with the Green Party, I think it was 2009. So that was the legislation that we had. That was the legislation that had the majority in the parliament. When the crisis hit us, and it hit us mainly in the autumn 2015, because out of 163,000 asylum seekers coming to Sweden in 2015, most of them came from September, October, until the end of the year. We were the ones who changed the legislation to make it more equal to other countries in our neighborhood, because the problem for Sweden was that the old legislation implemented by the Conservative government, it was more favorable to refugees compared to Denmark, Finland, Germany and other countries. We were the ones who implemented a tougher legislation.
Nevertheless, that is still a lot of people that came to Sweden, which is still a relatively small country. I'm just wondering if you think, because it is such a huge issue for the upcoming EU elections, for Sweden's most recent election, and it is the issue that xenophobic populists across Europe bang on and on and on and on about because it works for them. Like, I think the Brexit referendum in 2016 was essentially a referendum on immigration. I'm just wondering if you think there's a danger that broadly pro-immigration parties kind of get bounced into an impossible position of having to say all immigration is good, we should have more of it, just in order to identify themselves as opposition to the xenophobes.
No, I don't think so. That's not the scenery I see. There's no one saying, oh, let's bring in more and more people. We've never said that. This is an issue of A, refugees, we have to stand up for the right to seek asylum. B, we have other kind of immigration also, people coming to Sweden directly to work or to study. That's another category. And we need to integrate, because that's a crucial thing. People coming to Sweden need to be integrated into the society. That means that we need to deal with housing, with the training, education, and all that requires people to be integrated. So if we have a balance on that, migration is not a problem. We need, in Sweden, given the demography, we will need in the future people to move to Sweden. Europe will need people moving to Europe because we have a shortage of workforce. And that's why the whole 2015 argued, and after that as well, that we need a common legislation in Europe so that we can handle this together. Then we'll be able to handle the situation, giving refugees asylum that they have the right to have, but also making sure that we have the right workforce. So migration will be something that we just need to deal with it. Because if we say we don't do that, well, that will be a huge problem in the future. But we have to balance people coming into the country with measures that make them integrated into the society so that people living in the country already can see, okay, they're coming here, they're also making an effort and making something good for our country.
Where do you think Sweden has fallen short on the integration, though? Because obviously a connection has been made between the arrivals of large numbers of people and the increasing and quite extraordinary problem Sweden is having with gang-related violence. There were 50 people killed in gun violence in Sweden in 2023, more than 140 bombings reported related to gang violence, which is the kind of drawback that even broadly pro-immigration populations can start to get a bit tired of.
It's about inequality. If people don't get a chance to be integrated in the same way as people already living there, well, you will have problems. We've had too few apartments being built for many years during the government, before the government I led. We started to increase the building of apartments and houses dramatically so that everybody knows, well, that's not an issue. Everybody can have their chance to a decent housing. But also training. need to increase training, need to increase mobility in the workforce, and so on and so on. We introduced and implemented measures so we could see that we shortened the time for immigrants to actually being able to enter into the labor market. We shortened it. It was 9 years for 50% of a group of immigrants when we took office. When I left, it was four and a half years. So that's, again, what we need, and that is often linked to the integration measures.
But arguments like that, because they are quite nuanced and complicated and subtle, they don't really cut through against the populist xenophobes. I mean, I know the PEP recently suspended the smear party of the Slovakian Prime Minister Robert Fico and the Hlas party of President-elect Peter Pellegrini of Slovakia. And after that suspension, big dip in the polls for your party and a bit of a spike for Identity and Democracy, because this just reinforces their narrative that the establishment is trying to thwart the people's will.
Again, you have to stand for something. And the problem with those, the people that you mentioned, is also that they're saying Putin is, we want peace. And we say you have to stand up for Ukraine. You have to do that. We have to do that. And other signals, if you say, no, Russia is not a problem and we should just make peace today. Well, make peace today is what we just heard Zelensky. Mm. Making peace today is that Ukraine loses. And then the world order is gone. UN Charter is gone. So that we have to stand up for. So in those cases you mentioned, is mostly they are more pro-Russia than pro-Europe. And that's a problem.
That was Stefan Löfven, former Prime Minister of Sweden, now President of European Socialists. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. You're listening to The Foreign Desk on Monocle Radio. Next, we'll hear from Ruxandra Ivan, State Councillor for European Affairs to the Prime Minister of Romania, which joined the EU along with its neighbour, Bulgaria, on New Year's Day 2007. I began by asking her if Prime Minister Marcel Ciolacu, who got the job last June, has a vision for the role Romania can play in Eastern Europe.
Yes, he has a vision for the role of Romania. Because of the constitutional architecture in Romania, most of the foreign policy competences belong to the president, and the prime minister is mainly focusing on economic issues. So he has done that since taking on the mandate. For example, one of our most successful economic cooperations have developed with Germany during these more than 9 months of mandate. So we are really pushing towards transforming Romania into an important hub in this new geopolitical configuration in which, for example, the solidarity lanes have become so important for getting out the grains of Ukraine. But also we are trying to become a hub for transport in the perspective of the reconstruction of Ukraine. So from our point of view, Romania is, because of its geopolitical position, it can play an important role in the difficult geopolitical context that we are facing.
It's a glib and inevitably crass way to put it, but is it almost, for all the peril that Eastern Europe is in, the renewed attention given to Eastern Europe, is there perhaps an opportunity for Eastern European countries, Romania in particular?
Yes, of course it is. And, well, maybe it is also time for Western European countries, as well as our NATO partners, to listen more to what Eastern European countries have to say, because most of the Eastern European countries have warned about the Russian danger before the invasion 2 years ago.
I mean, for although that Romania is protected by Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, does this still feel potentially like it might be a direct threat to Romania at some point?
I won't speak of a direct threat more than the other states in the region, but of course the geographic position is itself a vulnerability, and I think the Romanians are not the only ones who are feeling that there is a threat. This is the reason why countries like Sweden and Finland have asked to join NATO recently, because they are also very close to Russia and because probably they are also feeling threatening. So yes, there is a threat.
Does Romania's government, though, worry specifically about Moldova as a vulnerability?
We believe that Moldova is the second most exposed state to the war in Ukraine. And now there is a hybrid war going on in Ukraine through the Russian propaganda. And this is why we also believe that European Union member states should also help Moldova to face this fake news threat and instability threat by providing aid, economic aid, and other kind of assistance that the Republic of Moldova needs. So yes, we believe that indeed the Republic of Moldova is the second most affected state by the war, and we are trying to fully support it.
But on that front, though, Romania has announced significant increases in defence spending. Is this a priority of the government now as well, that Romania needs to be a much more militarily assertive nation?
It is not a significant increase, because up until now we had 2% of the GDP allocated for defence, and now we are raising that to 2.5%. So yes, we are concerned. We believe that we need to enhance our capabilities, but I wouldn't say that this is the primary concern. But yes, indeed, it is a concern.
I just want to go back finally to specifically Romania's relationship with Europe, and I guess where the balance of power and balance of focus in Europe might be shifting. When you think of perhaps the future of Europe beyond, you know, one hopes the imminent end of the war in Ukraine, and what seems likely that will follow from that, Ukraine joining the EU, Ukraine joining NATO, do you feel like that Europe's balance of power could be tilting quite dramatically eastwards, that this will be the new power block of the future?
Well, there have been discussions 10 years already about the so-called new Europe. I don't know. I believe that European solidarity, both West and East, both old member states and new member states, is really crucial for achieving things together, because this is the basis of the European Union, doing things together and improving the life of the citizens. I can't wait that the war is over and we should orient ourselves towards that again. Offering a better life for the citizens was also the reason why people in Central and Eastern Europe wanted to join the European Union. So I hope there will not be a cleavage between Eastern Europe and Western Europe, because it's not what we hope for.
That was Ruxandra Ivan, State Councillor for European Affairs to the Prime Minister of Romania, speaking to us at the recent Delphi Economic Forum. This is the Foreign Desk on Monocle Radio. While parts of Eastern Europe are still clamouring to get into the EU, one EU country, or at least 52% of its voters, won Thursday in June 2016, has clamoured to get out. But has the emergency occasioned by Russia's assault on Ukraine narrowed the English Channel at all? I'm joined now by Anand Menon, political scientist and director of UK in a Changing Europe. Anand, did Russia's attack on Ukraine at all change the UK's relationship with Europe?
I mean, the answer, I suppose, is yes and no. Yes, in the sense that it underlines shared strategic interests. Yes, in the sense that it pushed the UK to work more closely with the European Union, coordinating on sanctions and things like that. Yes, in that it has intensified conversations between the UK and European allies about military cooperation. But nothing structural about our relationship with the European Union has changed as a result of Ukraine. And there's been a lot of talk, for instance, about the Labour Party coming in and signing a defence pact. So it might yet happen, but at the moment it has been more sort of ad hoc than institutional.
We will come back to the degree to which a change of government in the UK might change anything in its relationship with Europe. But there was a line which was trotted out, perhaps rather hopefully, by the British government, that in the early stages of the crisis in Ukraine, the fact of Brexit gave the UK greater freedom to operate, greater freedom indeed for Boris Johnson, the then Prime Minister, to take the lead on rallying support for Ukraine. Is there anything to that at all? Would the government of this country have been constrained in the slightest by still being a member of the EU?
Not legally, no. There's nothing to it at all. And, you know, if you think back to Iraq, where the EU divided neatly into two camps with fundamentally opposing views, you can see that when it comes to foreign policy, countries do what's in their interest and they don't feel in any sense tied by intra-European Union loyalty. What did change, I think, and it's harder to sort of pinpoint, but I do think it matters, is Brexit provided a political incentive to show that the UK was still an important and active international actor. And my sense is Brexit contributed to a feeling in Downing Street that, look, we're going to have to take the lead on this. Because taking the lead on it, which Britain did, you know, full credit to Britain, we were first out of the traps. We were the noisiest in our support of Ukraine from the start. And I think a part of that, at least, was down to that political incentive to show that Brexit notwithstanding, we can get out there and lead the pack.
If we think about that situation from the other perspective, was there any sense that you were able to detect that the fact of the invasion of Ukraine and the way that changed the strategic calculus made the EU a bit more forgiving of the UK, perhaps, and maybe a bit more willing to accommodate the UK as a partner of some kind, given the UK's value as a military and strategic resource?
I think my answer to that is absolutely not. The sense that, yes, the EU wants to work with us on security. Yes, the EU is keen to collaborate, but in both senses, they want to do that on their own terms. So if you take what is perhaps one of the most difficult aspects of our security relationship, the European Union has created something called the European Defence Fund to allow member states to collaborate on weapons manufacturing and procurement. Okay. It makes no sense to think of European defence broadly with the UK left out of that, but EU rules prohibit, to a significant extent, UK involvement. And there's been no sign, notwithstanding Ukraine, of the EU thinking, we better change our rules in this changed strategic context.
As you have already cunningly foreshadowed, it is generally anticipated that the government of this country will change within the next, well, what are we up to? 7 months at the absolute most. We have already in recent months seen barely constrained rejoicing among the EU at a fairly significant change of heart in one of its member states, i.e. Poland, where a Eurosceptic or at least Euro-irritating government was replaced by a very, very, very pro-Europe one. Were the government to change in the UK, and it is important to stress that Labour, the current opposition, has absolutely not raised any discussion whatsoever of the prospect of rejoining the EU, but would the relationship nevertheless change, do you think, if an amount of the Brexit baggage was discarded?
Well, I mean, there's several questions bundled up there. I think the first thing to say is the EU aren't getting out the party poppers at the prospect of a Labour government for a couple of reasons, I think. One, because we're not a member state, so it matters to them less than what happens in a member state. But two, because actually relations between this government and the European Union are pretty good. We're not at the nadir of the time under Boris Johnson where it was seen as good politics here to be at loggerheads with the European Union. The Sunak government works quite closely with the European Union. We work quite closely, as we saw with Sunak's trip to Warsaw and to Berlin last week, with individual European governments. Diplomatically, relations are quite good. When it comes to Labour, it's clear Labour want to maintain close, good, friendly diplomatic relations with the EU, but they're not going to do very much to try and shift the relationship as far as we can tell. They might negotiate a couple of bolt-ons to the existing trade treaty. They might try and negotiate something on security, but Labour aren't proposing a wholesale review of post-Brexit trading relationships. And the EU, for their part, are thinking, OK, that's fine. If you want to negotiate something, we'll talk to you. But we're only going to give you something if it's in our interest. We're not going to give you presents because you're not Conservatives.
Nevertheless, is it imaginable that after Labour, led by Sir Keir Starmer, have been in power for a while, things might start to shift? Obviously, at the moment, Labour and Sir Keir are very much in the mode of thinking all we have to do is stay in one piece until election day and we're going to win this thing. So they don't need to make any dramatic promises. But once in power, especially with a big enough majority to see them through a couple of terms, can you imagine the UK, I don't know, within a decade or so, starting to edge towards maybe some kind of Switzerland or Norway style of arrangement with the EU?
I mean, look, after the last 10 years we've had in this country, I think it would be idiotic to rule anything out definitively. I mean, who knows? What I would say is, firstly, how ambitious Labour are will hinge partly on what happens in the election. So how big their majority is and what kind of mess the Tories are in afterwards. You could imagine a scenario after an election where you're thinking, realistically, this is 10 years because the Tories are a mess and Labour are in. Or you can think, oh, that's quite a tight majority. The Conservatives are holding it together. This might be only 5 years. If it's only 5 years, obviously Labour will be more cautious. Now, let's imagine they have the perspective of 10 years. It's conceivable they'll be more ambitious. I don't think there is a desire among the leadership at the moment. I don't think Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer are politicians who obsess about Europe. I think they see it instrumentally. I don't think they've got a sort of European vision for the country. So they're not ideologically sort of predetermined to say, let's get closer to the European Union. They might come under pressure to do so from within their own party, from businesses, for instance. The one thing I'd say about Switzerland and Norway is Norway in particular, in the case of Norway, the country is a rule taker. It's in the single market. It basically applies all single market rules, but it has no real say. It has a limited say and it has no vote. I do not think that sort of situation is going to be politically sustainable in the United Kingdom. I would be amazed if the United Kingdom ended up being a member of the single market without being a member of the European Union. And on membership of the single market, bear in mind that that involves not only becoming a rule taker, but also accepting freedom of movement and, of course, paying into the budget.
Anand Menon at UK in a Changing Europe, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. Finally on today's show, to a country still on the outside looking in. We'll hear now from Radica Crudu, Secretary of State for European Integration in Moldova. This interview was also done at the Delphi Economic Forum, which explains the birdsong. I began by asking whether Moldova's target date of joining the EU in 2030 still seems achievable.
We are pretty confident that we can do that because since we got the candidate status to the European Union and we have the decision of the European Council to open the accession talks, that gave us a clear perspective where our country is heading to, but also a clear path of ensuring a better and more secure life and future for our citizens, but also a clear signal that we are on the right track with our ambitious reform agenda to build at home a modern European state. We didn't start back in 2022. You know that we started even earlier when we signed the association agreement back in 2016, and therefore a lot of reforms are undergoing. We know that it's not an easy process, but we are firmly determined to continue to move things ahead.
I mean, there is a lot that needs doing in that extremely short period of time, and there are countries in the Western Balkans region that have been working on EU accession for a lot longer. But the big one that I know that leaps out at people is obviously the one of Transnistria. Does that need to be resolved before EU accession is possible? I know the EU ambassador to Moldova, Yanis Matsix, has suggested maybe not, but is it actually possible that the Transnistria issue could be resolved by 2030?
Transnistria, first I would like to start with the fact that Transnistria is the geographical territory of the Republic of Moldova, and we treat this as part of our country. Indeed, we have the special status out there, and we have the Russian interference out there. There are a lot of discussions whether we have to resolve the Transnistria conflict. Is that the backbone in the association of Moldova and joining the Moldova to the EU? But we have to take into account also that we have other countries that managed to join the European Union with a similar, I would say, conflict inside the country, and that's Cyprus, you know? And in the, we received a draft of negotiation framework. It doesn't specifically specify anything about the Transnistria conflict and the region, and we are pretty confident that we will go hand in hand and we'll manage to integrate both sides of the river Dnieper, which are splitting Moldova with Transnistria.
You're right to point out that work has been going on between Moldova and the EU for quite a number of years now, but nevertheless, President Maia Sandu signed the application to join barely a week after Russia attacked Ukraine in 2022. How important do you think this is for Moldova's future security, EU membership? I know Moldova is constitutionally prohibited from joining NATO as it presently stands, but do you feel like being a member of the EU makes Moldova safer?
We do see the European integration project as a project of ensuring peace and security, and that's what EU has managed to prove throughout more than 70 years. And having the war at the border of the country becomes more preeminent, that need to ensure security and peace. And of course, as I mentioned before, having the candidate status and opening the accession talks gives us a clear perspective that we can ensure, we can move further towards ensuring that security and peace at home. But also we have to keep in mind that accession process is a merit-based process, and we really focus on reforming and implementing the reform agenda at home. And in here, I would like to mention the judiciary reform that we are undergoing, which is probably the most complex process of all our reform endeavors. But despite the difficulties and the resistance, by the way, that comes from inside the system itself,
sure,
we managed to achieve some accomplishments. We have been also working hard to strengthen the capacity of the anti-corruption prosecutor office. We've allocated a lot of money. We've changed the organizational structure to make sure that they have full capacity to fight against corruption. So to keep the story short, even in this complicated area, we managed to move ahead, and we are very proud and determined to continue inclusively with selecting an independent and an expert, and a dedicated person for the general prosecutor position.
That was Radhika Krudu speaking to us at the Delphi Economic Forum. And that's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Chris Chermak and Christy O'Grady. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. To contact The Foreign Desk team, you can email Chris at cc@monocle.com. And don't forget to subscribe to Monocle Magazine and to our free daily email bulletins by heading to our website at monocle.com. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.